Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans.
Oh, give it a rest. You're under new management. It's Pete and Gary's Military History Podcast now.
Hello, and welcome to Pete and Gary's Military History Sausage. And what have we got on the what have we got today, Gary?
Today, Pete, we've got Ball on the Somme.
Ball on the Somme? Does that go with Somme Success?
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't called this Somme Success. You've called everything else Somme Success. It's product placement, I think they call that.
Now, what's happened is that, rather a lot on the First World War, rather a lot on First World War aviation in the next few weeks. We've just gone mad on it. And while we were doing some success, we were attracted to, let's be honest, Gary, you were attracted to the personality and the career of Albert Ball, weren't you?
I'm just attracted to balls.
That may be one of the rare cuts that Matt makes.
And to be fair, Pete, this is the stuff that we're doing about the air war is because people have been asking us to do it, haven't they? We've had a number of requests, mostly to go away, but some of them
stop doing accents.
Yeah, some of them were about
a rather
the air
harsh
war.
One to stop breathing. I thought that was a little over the top.
Yeah, but Janet can be like that.
Yeah, she can. Right, so tell me a bit about Albert Ball. Set the background for me.
Well, he was born in Nottingham on the 10th of January 1898.
Ah.
Yeah, we know lots of people that are coming from Nottingham. It seems the place to come from.
It's and not the... just that, it's the date, Gary, the date.
Oh, he's born on the 10th of January. What's your birth date, Pete?
The 10th of January, 1915. Just 17 years after him.
Wow.
Wow.
You've aged well.
I have aged well. I've aged beautifully. So who is he? Who is he? Who is he? Who is he?
He's the son of a wealthy businessman.
I think he was Lord Mayor for a while of Nottingham.
Well, he was certainly prominent in local politics. That's true.
He was a big knob.
He was a big knob. Now, Ball was academically undistinguished. He had a bit of a mechanical bent, which he fully indulged in a variety of boyish hobbies. Oh, I had a variety of boyish hobbies.
Yes.
Before leaving school in 1913, when he took up a position in an engineering firm. Now, on the outbreak of war, he answered the call and he enlisted in the ranks of the... 2nd, 7th Sherwood Foresters on the 21st of September 1914. So he was in there right from the beginning.
So I make him about 16 then? Take two, carry one, divide by
that's
three.
That's 16, yeah. Is that right?
Mm. Yeah, right. I wonder if that's right. We haven't done... I want to say that this podcast is concentrating on his career as a pilot. So this is just a quick scurry through. His background. There are some excellent books, but I think Chas Beyer wrote one. If you Google Albert Ball, or indeed Alan Ball, you'll get lots of interesting results. So he's commissioned almost immediately as a second lieutenant, and he's seconded to a cyclist unit. But he's anxious to get to the front. So what does he do, Gary?
He pays for some private flying instruction, so his chances increase of getting into the ever expanding RFC. Now he passes the Royal.
So he wants to get in the Royal Flying Corps. Is that for excitement and because of the mechanical bent, so to speak? Do you think what's going on there?
I think that's a little bit of both. He wants to get to the front. He wants to be in the action, but he absolutely has this skill with mechanics and that he wants to put to the test. Now he passes the Royal Aero Club's pilot's examination and he's transferred to the RFC for further training with 9th Reserve Squadron. And he gets a final polish at the Central Flying School, where all pilots are polished.
I believe a lot of them get a final polish there, yes. Good Lord.
I like the idea of the pilots all being polished. I would have been one of the polishers.
Yes, I can imagine, yeah.
Polish, sir? Oh, dear me. Now, after a brief interlude with 22 Squadron at Gospel, Ball's posted out to France and he joins the 13th Squadron flying B2Cs on the 18th of February 1916. So it looks like that date might be about right, Pete, because he's certainly in France from 1916.
Yeah, 18. Right, now tell me. Let's a bit of a test of your memory. What's the B2C like then? Is it a great aeroplane? What's its main feature, would you say?
Flapping wings.
That is entirely and utterly wrong. It's very stable.
It's very stable. It's designed it's designed to aid observation and photography, isn't it? So it's a very stable platform, I think, is how it's described.
Good for flinging about the sky should you be attacked by a Fokker of some description?
No, but it's very good for flinging about the floor.
Afterwards.
After you'd met a Fokker, yes.
You'll find a, yeah. So it's a strange machine. I often say it's the most effective killing machine in the Great War, but killing by means of the wireless transmitter linking it to the artillery. And before we go any further, both of us want to make the point that it's the core squadron pilots, like flying the BTCs and such like, that are the unsung heroes of the war. The fact that this podcast is about Albert Ball doesn't remove our acknowledgement of the importance of artillery observation and photographic reconnaissance. So that's just before we go on.
And we've made that point a number of times, Peter, haven't we?
We have. In fact, people keep saying, will you stop making that bloody point, you pair of boring sods? Notice I put the word sods in after your little lecture about swearing.
Now, at 13th Squadron, he's engaged in the normal duties of a core squadron pilot, although he took every chance he could to fly the attached Bristol Scout. So he's anxious there to get into the scouts from day one, really. Now his potential, a bit like me, really, his potential may well have been recognised as on the 7th of May. Hang on.
That's your birthday.
That's my birthday, and remember that date, Pete. The 7th of May.
Well, he was transferred. Remember it for about a month,
aren't they? He was transferred to 11th Squadron. Who were in the process of forming a flight of Bristol and Newport Scouts. Now, they originally had the Vickers machines, I think, colloquially referred to as the gun bus. Now, 11th Squadron was established at Netheravon in 1915, and I went there with a very good friend of ours a couple of years ago, actually, about 3 or 4 years ago. So it was still there, although not operational.
Well, the mess is very interesting, the Royal Flying Corps original mess. Yeah, it's great. Now, 11th Squadron, they're forming a flight of Bristol and Newport Scouts, aren't they? And these two, we'll come back to the Newport. They're both basically single-seaters with the machine gun. Well, in Lano Hawker's time, it was just stuck on the side, pointing out at an angle, but usually on the top wing. Let's concentrate on the Newport Scout, because that's the one that becomes most linked with his name. So that's a single-seater, as it's a scout. It's a tractor biplane. What's a tractor? Let's test you on that. Is it a big thing in the field when applied to aviation, or is it something else, Gary?
No, that's the propellers in front of the pilot, and it's effectively pulling the plane along rather than a pusher where it's behind the pilot.
Now, it's a powerful machine for its time. It's got a 110 horsepower Lerone engine, and it can get up to 110 mile per hour. I'm not sure about that. That sounds like an optimistic speed. With a service ceiling of 15,000 feet. It's superior, really, in every respect to the Fokker, except for one thing. What's that, Gary?
That'll be the armament, Pete.
Yeah. All it's got is a single fixed forward-firing Lewis gun on the wing, the top of the wing, above the, in essence, above the pilot's head.
How many rounds in a Lewis gun, Pete?
47. I don't know why you ask an acknowledged aviation historian who's been had it hammered into him over the last 2 weeks and has written it down in his notes. 47 rounds. So how does this work? Does he stand up in the seat? No. What he does is it's got a wire coming down, and there's a sort of it's a Bowden wire grip on the joystick to the Lewis gun. So he doesn't have to stand up to fire. He just sits down and he fires it by using the Bowden grip on the joystick.
Now, this is still dodging the central requirement for a synchronised gun, isn't it? Because it's directing its fire above the span of the propeller.
Yeah, it's well, the British, with the exception of Sopwith 1.5 Strutter, my favourite name ever. Try and work it into everything. Sopwith 1.5 Strutter, what a machine! Anyway, it's dodging the main issue. And the French had very kindly made some of the Newport 16s available to the British. And they doled them out at first. But remember, there's no such thing originally as scout squadrons. They dole them out to the scout pilots attached to the reconnaissance squadrons, except for 11 squadron. Second Lieutenant Albert Ball, he begins his remarkable career on as a scout pilot with an unconfirmed first victory flying a Bristol Scout above Givenchy on the 16th of May. And we're going to take it in turns. Well, not in turns. We do have groups together. And you're going to be, for the start, Second Lieutenant Albert Ball. What does he say about his first victory?
I was on patrol yesterday morning on my British Scout. I was at 12,000 feet and saw a Hun at 5,000. It started off and I went after it, catching it up when 20 miles over its own lines. It took 120 shots to do it in, but in the end, it went down, upside down.
That's interesting. 120 shots. He doesn't take that many later on in his career. But everybody has to gain experience. In fact, if you want to kill someone in the air, it's best to catch them before they've got used to it, isn't it? Experience really counts. Now, as a scout pilot with 11 Squadron, it's Ball's role to protect the slower, vulnerable reconnaissance machine as they trundle up and down on the battlefields. And also... to engage in offensive patrols to seek out and destroy German aircraft, wherever they may be found. And he gradually builds up experience, and within sort of like a couple of weeks, he's in a series of combats. And on 29th of May, he's in four combats, just one after the other in that single day. Take us through that, Gary.
I had four flights in one patrol on my Newport and came off top in every fight. Four Fokkers and an LVG attacked me about 12 miles over the lines. I forced the LVG down with a drum and a half, after which I zoomed up after the Fokkers. They ran away at once. Out of all the fights, I only got about 8 shots into my machine. One just missed my back and hit the strut. However, on my way back, the Hun Archie guns hit the tail of my machine and took a piece away. But I got back and have now got a new tail. The other fights were with Albatross machines. General Higgins sent for me on landing and was very pleased.
That's the Brigadier. Interesting. Just to 2 points. Archie, as you remember, is... Archie, certainly not, is German anti-aircraft guns. And the Albatross machines are not the Albatross scouts. They're the Albatross reconnaissance machines from the time. Now, 25th of June, they're planning to launch... a simultaneous coordinate. They're building up to the Battle of the Somme. Of course they are. And they plan to launch a simultaneous coordinated attack on every German observation balloon all along the British front. Their eyes in the sky, aren't they? It's obvious they need to put them out, so to speak, just before the big offensive, the big push. Now 20 squadrons sent with a group of aircraft with phosphorus bombs to try and set fire to them. They haven't really got the hang of a lot of this. But when the rails finally get off the crowds, low crowds hamper the attack. I think there's 23 German kite balloons are supposed to be in the air. And now Ball takes part in these attacks. He just got back from leave, actually, obviously well earned. And he says this about what happened that day. So, 25th of June. So take us through it, Albert.
Oh, it was rotten, for I only just got back. Three of us were sent from this squadron. The first time we did no good, so I asked for another chance. We all set out again. I went for my balloon and set it on fire, but my engine was badly hit and I had to come back all the 8 miles over Hunland at half speed and only a few feet up. My machine was hit badly. I've enclosed one of the bullets. This bullet went through my induction pipe, engine bearer plate and 3 inches of wood. Not so bad, is it? The other chaps were not very successful. One crashed his machine and the other did no good. The other four balloons were brought down by other squadrons. Five were brought down by the RFC. About 100 machines went up for different balloons, so I think five is quite a good average for such a rotten job. You see, we had to get so low.
It's not just that. The balloons were defended by quite a lot of German machine guns, and these weird anti-aircraft guns that fired things called green onions. Yeah, green onions. Well, they could play havoc with your insides, Gary. Oh, it's hell in there. So 27th, 28th of June, there's a thick mist all over the Somme area, the Somme Valley in particular, you know, the river where the river is. And then there's showery rain and heavy cloud, and most patrols are cancelled. But Ball is very keen. And this is something you wanted to make clear. Ball is razor keen, isn't he, at all times. He wants to get up there. It's clear that his training as a corps pilot, as a reconnaissance pilot and the rest of it, isn't wasted. Because as he's flying, he's keeping his eyes peeled for significant developments on the ground. So what does he see?
I was on the 7 o'clock patrol today, and on my patrol, I saw over the lines a lot of transports, etc., in a wood. I went over the lines in order to have a good look, so that I could report the place. But the old Huns did not like it. They surrounded us with shells from their Archie guns, and at last we were hit. One of my cylinders was smashed off. Also, the machine got a few through it. One only just missed my leg. However, the engine stopped, but I saw what I went to see.
Now, this bad weather is severely impacting on the preparations for the Somme, the artillery observation, which is key to the Somme battle. It does cause trouble. They're also, the duties are innumerable. They're also making bombing raids. Now, bombing raids, they're sort of primitive interdiction and raids on particular things. They're not very effective because the bombs aren't very effective. But on 30th of June, he's acting as an escort. What does he say?
Yesterday, we did two bombing raids. On the first one, I had to lead, for the wing commander had to land owing to engine trouble. It was great sport as 30 machines went. On the second, it was more sport still. Three Fokkers came for us, but we did the job okay and set the place on fire. However, you will think I am a very bloodthirsty chap just now, but I'm not really.
Yeah, he is. Now, the thing is, these Newport scout pilots, people like Ball, they've got offensive patrols, escort work. They've got what do you think builds up? What could happen to the average young chap? Keen, razor keen or not? What's building up, Gary?
Well, the stress is unremitting, isn't it, Pete? So they'd start to show some of the signs of the strain that they're under.
Yeah, and this is the things we're quoting from are from his letters of the time, and this is one of the letters he wrote to his family at this time.
The three Newport machines stand from 2:30 a.m. until 9:30 at night, so you bet we're getting a rotten time just now. However, things are looking good just now, so we might all help and keep things going at any cost. But it is a long day, and I'm afraid that if it lasts very long, a few of the chaps will be going sick. I'm okay, but oh, so fagged. However, I shall soon get over that.
Now, he's getting some notification. I mean, people are noticing him by this time. 29th of June, he gets the Military Cross is awarded to him. During this period, we did a whole thing on the Battle of the Somme, so we're not going to hammer this home. But the RFC's got a real numerical and qualitative superiority established over the Somme battlefields. The arrival of a whole new generation of aircraft is really helping. It doesn't affect Ball much because he's in the Newport Scout, but the DH-2s, the FE-2Bs, the Sopwith 1.5 strutters, they're all arriving, and they give an aerial supremacy just when it really counts, just when the offensive is going to happen. And although the staff officers and generals always want more, don't they? But do you think they got what they could expect? Do you think that the RFC performed well?
Yeah, I think, you know, you've got to think about Trenchard's aggressive strategy. They were out there all the time, come what may. And basically, they provided all the photographs that could reasonably be expected of the German trenches, for example, the reserve lines and the strong points. Many of the German batteries had been engaged or their positions registered. The German reserve troops had been harassed by the bombing of their billets, and the crucial rail routes to the battlefield had been disrupted in the later stages. No German aircraft had been able to cross the British front line to expose the details of the offensive preparations to the German high command. Trenchard could be rightly proud of his men.
Oh, and I think he was. Was there a bit of a let-up after the 1st of July then?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the missions still had to be flown every day, and the schedules are real strain, even for the bravest of the brave. Those that managed to survive were kept going by a sort of muddled mixture of motives in which a sense of duty mingled with the desire not to let down their mates or expose themselves to ridicule. And as the pressure mounted, their youthful resilience was tested to the absolute limit. Now, because it's used the words youthful resilience, you're now going to be Second Lieutenant Albert Ball.
Well, we've got to change voices, haven't we, every so often. And this is Albert Ball writing about this sort of situation. Some of the expressions are a bit public schooly, but I'm going to read it as it is. I'm going to read it straight because this is a brave young chap under a lot of pressure. I'm feeling poo-poo croc today. I went up this morning after three hands and managed to get underneath them, but could not get nearer than 3,000 feet owing to my engine. I'm spending the remainder of the day trying to get it right. Remember that mechanical bent of his? You asked me to let the devils have it when I fight. Yes! I always let them have it, have all I can. But really, I don't think them devils. I only scrap because it is my duty. But I do not think anything bad about the Hun. He is just a good chap with very little guts, trying to do his best. Nothing makes me feel more rotten than to see them go down. But you see, it's either them or me. So I must do my best to make it a case of them.
Now, compared to the infantry, the casualties are slight, Pete, but in a small unit, and we've said this previously, a casualty a day would soon wipe out the original personnel of a squadron. And although squadrons were ceaselessly regenerated by replacements, it didn't require much perception to work out that the odds of surviving a prolonged tour of duty were minimal, frankly.
Now, yeah, I suppose so.
You're going to go on to say for Albert Ball.
Yep. This is quite an interesting one. It directly addresses those points you made. This is what Ball says. Really, one has only just time to button up one's tunic. I'm having a poo-poo time, but most interesting. On the 6th, three topping chaps went off and never returned. Yesterday, four of my best pals went off. And today one of our new chaps has gone over. So you can guess we're always having to get used to new faces. Yesterday I was up at 5 a.m. and during the day had 12 flights. But at last nature is asking to have its own way. However, I'm not done yet. I shall get at them again soon. What do you think that, what's that showing, Gary?
Well, it's starting to show he's suffering from the strain. But also, if you've got that many replacements coming into a unit, you're not going to want to get to know them. You're going to keep a distance because it's starting to hurt him. He's starting to notice his comrades and his chums are not coming back.
Does he do?
Well, although he'd recently had a period of leave, he does something quite unusual. He puts in a direct request to his squadron leader for more rest. Now, this is bold in the extreme. And Brigadier General...
I'm sure they treat him with the kindness and consideration that one of their foremost aces deserves.
Oh, absolutely. Brigadier General J.F.A. Higgins, commanding 3rd Brigade, could not grant the request. Now... Ooh. It says it would inevitably set a dangerous precedent if every exhausted pilot could take rest as they pleased.
Well, that's true, isn't it? Let's not beat about the bush.
I mean, as you say, this is one of their high-performing pilots. He's clearly starting to show some physical strain, and they're not prepared to let him rest. I think it's madness. Now, the next quote, Pete, is again, it's Albert Ball, and you're going to read that one for us.
I am. Here we go. The day before yesterday, we had a big day. At night, I was feeling very rotten, and my nerves were poo-poo. Naturally, I cannot keep on forever. So at night, I went to see the CO and asked him if I could take a short rest and not fly for a few days. He said he would do his best. What has taken place has been that I have been sent to number 8 squadron, back on the B2Cs. Oh, I'm feeling in the dumps.
Very restful.
So what has he done? He's not only but not got a rest, but he's been taken off his lovely Newport Scout and sent back to the dreaded B2Cs. So our best fighter pilot, so at the time, I think it's fair to say, our best acknowledged fighter pilot, is as a punishment, has been sent to a death trap.
Yeah, and throughout early August, Second Lieutenant Albert Ball serves his penance on punishment posting with the 8th Squadron. Now, from a modern perspective, it seems that Brigadier General Higgins was cutting off his nose to spite his face. Ball had asked for a rest and instead had been condemned, maybe that's the right word, to a return to flying B2Cs. The RFC had lost the service of one of their very best and most inspirational scout pilots and put him in a role where he faced as much risk without employing his talents.
Yeah. I love it. I love the military. They are a wonderful thing.
In reality, you know, Higgins might well have hit the right course of action because Ball undoubtedly found the regular routine of artillery observation and bombing flights far less stressful than the pell-mell life of a scout pilot, and he's able to recover much of his early zest for the fray.
Yeah, well, it's noticeable. He plays a full part in the day-to-day work of 8th Squadron, but really, I think it's fair to say he's not as other BU2C pilots as he is.
No.
He's always looking for a bit of adventure, excitement. There's a couple of things he does. On one occasion, he volunteers to land a spy the other side of German lands. Lines, not lands. Well, they are German lands at the time. But, yeah. Anyway, I'm going to read this. And I quite like this. So here we go. It's tempting to do a Blundock voice, but because it is amazing. We got over the lines, and after a few seconds, 3 Fokkers came after us. We had no gun, for the machine could not carry his luggage, etc., and guns. So we had to dodge the beasts. At last it was so dark they couldn't see us, so they went down. The Archie guns started. Also, rockets were sent up to try and set us on fire. Oh, it was nice. I really did think that the end had come. The planes were lit up with the flashes. That's his wings. However, at last we found a landing place and we started down. Naturally, everything had to be done quickly or we should have been caught. But we got down. Picture my temper when we landed. The damned spy would not get out. The Fokkers had frightened him and he wouldn't risk it. There's nothing to do but get off again before the Hun came along and stopped us. So off we went. I went down 3 times again after this, but the rudder refused to do his part. so he had to return. I love the idea of Ball with this bloke who's lost his nerve landing three times behind enemy lines. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
I'd have physically thrown him out.
Yeah. I mean, he must have been in a state of abject terror with this lunatic pilot going, go on in, go on in, get out, get out, get out now. All right, get out now then, get out now. Now, he also uses his Bu-2C to launch an attack on a pair of observation balloons. The German, you know, and we've mentioned the flaming onions, the green onions, the giant sausages, all these things. They were often called sausage balloons. And this is what Ball says. On Wednesday, August 9th, I attacked a balloon with a BE and forced the observer to jump out. Not his observer, although his observer probably felt like jumping out. The balloon observer. On the way back from this job, my main spar and wing tip was crashed. But we got back to the aerodrome. Can you imagine? Who am I flying with today? Oh, Albert. Oh, no.
Now, it's at this point he gets his wish and he's returned to 11th Squadron. I should think that 8th Squadron had quite a lot to do with that. And he returns on the 14th of August. His experience of air fighting has been broadened considerably, but it's not immediately apparent that it is immediately apparent that he's not abandoned his attacking philosophy one iota. And you're going to be Albert Ball again, aren't you, Pete? What does he say?
He says, you'll be surprised to hear that I have started with luck. I went up this morning and attacked five Hun machines. One I got and two I forced down. After this, I had to run. God, for all my ammunition was used. However, I got back okay with only two hits on my machine. Now, by now you should be getting just started to get the idea that he'll attack any number of planes and his aircraft doesn't come back unmarked in these battles. We'll come back to this. So what's he doing now then?
Well, he immediately resumes his former career, Pete. He's flying his Nieuport in ceaseless patrols across the German lines. And as you rightly say, he's seeking out trouble wherever he could find it. Now, he becomes the epitome of Trenchard's offensive spirit, that no odds were too great for him to cock a snoot at. And on the 22nd of August, he takes off as an escort to an FE-2B bombing mission. And now, during this mission, he runs into a large formation of German aircraft. And what does he say, Pete?
Well, this is an amazing account, isn't it? Met 12 Huns. Number one fight. I attacked and fired two drums, bringing the machine down just outside a village. All crashed up. Number two fight. I attacked and got under the machine, putting in two drums. Hun went down in flames. Number three flight. I attacked and put in one drum. Machine went down and crashed on a housetop. All these fights were seen and reported by other machines that saw them go down. I only got hit 11 times on the planes, so I returned and got more ammunition. This time luck was not all on the spot. I was met by about 14 Huns about 15 miles over their side. My windscreen was hit in four places, mirror broken, the spar of the left plane broken. Also, engine ran out of petrol. But I had good sport and good luck. But only just, for I was brought down about 1 mile over our side. So he'd run out of petrol and just drifted back, glided back.
Now, he's right. He's phenomenally lucky there, Pete, isn't he?
He is. But there's two things I noticed. The first thing I'll mention, because it's just in my head. You notice he's shooting aircraft down with two drums, that is, two times 47, as opposed to 120 rounds.
No, it's more than shoots, that. It's 97.
No, yeah, 2x47. Oh, 2x47.
If it's a twin pan drum, it holds 97 rounds.
He didn't have a twin drum then.
Oh, okay.
They don't come out yet. Oh, dear, I wish you'd read the notes. They come out later on. But so he's shooting people down with about 94.
You've made me feel a lot better, Pete. Thanks for that.
I just thought I'd help you there. And one of them, he shoots down with just one drum, i.e. 47 rounds. You're going to hear a lot of this 47, I think. So that's one thing. Remember that first account where he takes 120 rounds to shoot down?
Yeah.
Now he's just shooting down people with a few rounds. But there's something else that's apparent from this account. What is that? What is it? What else is there about Bull?
As I said, he's phenomenally lucky. He seemingly can fly into a hail of bullets time and time again, and he emerges with his aircraft absolutely shot to pieces, but he is unscathed.
And now, it doesn't fall out of the sky.
Now, luck's difficult to quantify objectively, but there's no doubt that whatever it was, he had it. I mean, even the comment about running out of fuel, Peter, you know, run out of petrol. That's the last thing you want to happen in the middle of a dogfight.
It is. Now, by this time, it's become apparent. People at, like, Trenchard at RFC headquarters, he's in charge of the RFC in the Western Front. The day of the multifunction squadron's gone, 11 squadrons shown the way, and it was obvious. What are the advantages? Again, this is something from your contract background. What are the advantages of having aircraft of all the same type? So whether it be BO2Cs or Newport Scouts or Bristol Scouts or Sausage Scouts, what is the advantage of having them all the same?
Well, for one thing, all the mechanics are working on the same aircraft, so they get to know the aircraft. All the spares that you need are the same, so you haven't got to have a mix and match. All the pilots are appropriately trained for that aircraft, so they haven't got to mix and match and change from one day and another. And let's not forget, some of those aircraft were very different in how they were structured and where the machine gun was placed, for example. So there were great advantages to having the same aircraft.
So they're gradually forming more, they're forming more scout squadrons as scout squadrons. And on 24th of August, as part of the reorganisation, Albert Ball leaves his squadron, 11 squadron, sorry, which squadron is he?
He's at 11th squadron then. He went back to the 11th squadron.
Yeah, he goes back and he's put in 60 Squadron, a very famous squadron it becomes later on, partly due to him, of course. And he's made a flight, he's given a command of a flight. He's a lieutenant by this time. And what started to happen? What are people starting to think? People in his new squadron, what are they thinking? What are they thinking? They're thinking, can I duplicate his success? Can I use Ball's methods? Now, Ball sums up his methods. What does he say?
When I get to close quarters, I generally pretend that I'm going to attack from above. The Hun gets ready to fire up at me as I pass over, and then I suddenly dive under his machine. And if I'm lucky, I empty a drum into his petrol tank and down he goes. Now, you referred to this in a podcast the other day, Pete, as the Ball's up.
Yeah, people jokingly did, because he'd fly underneath, just pull his gun down and just fire along. Now, this is a... Do you think this is a tactic that other pilots can do?
No, I mean, it's developed perfectly adjusted to him and the Newport, frankly, but it's individualised tactics, and it's beyond duplication by pilots who lack his skills and, frankly, let's face it, suicidal bravery.
And this is Lieutenant Roderick Hill, who was serving with him in 60 Squadron. And he's talking about Ball's tactics. To surprise his enemy, he made clever use of the Lewis gun mounted on the Newport Scout. There was a curved rail down which the gun had to run to change drums. By exerting pressure on one side of the stock of the gun, he held it rigid when nearly down and pointing upwards about 80 degrees. By a skillful manoeuvre and incidentally by pluck and determination, he was able to zoom up beneath his intended victim. Then, by a slight oscillation of the control stick to cause his gun to rake the target fore and aft at a range of 30 feet or so. I found that my own efforts to emulate Ball in reaching a favourable position beneath a Hun so irritated it that a melee ensued in which I soon lost any idea of what was underneath, what was its underneath, and what was its top. To say that Ball fought with his head is almost superfluous. He was evidently the offspring of a vixen and a lion. Sorry, a bit of trembling there. He would sight a formation of as many as 12 fans afar off, would rise into the sun, fly above them and fire off a burst or two. This would invariably shake the formation's nerve and cause it to open slightly. One pilot, a little more nervous or less disciplined than the rest, would lose his station. In a flash, Ball would be on him, and almost as soon the deadly shooting would send him up in flames. Wow.
Wow.
They couldn't copy him, could they?
No. I mean, Ball's willingness to attack large formations wasn't unique, but the sheer ferocity of his approach seemed to intimidate the German pilots, and many would be lacking in experience and themselves, and the berserker approach undoubtedly bred confusion amongst them. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it earlier. If you're not that experienced and you've got Albert Ball coming after you, you're in trouble.
Absolutely. So what is he? He's a skillful pilot. I think that he must be. Notice that the other bloke couldn't, Roderick Hill couldn't copy what he did. He's a brilliant marksman, I think. He's brave, who conquers his natural fears. They really only emerge in his letters home. It's not as if he's sat in the mess trembling, is it? He relies on his luck, doesn't he? As you said.
Yeah, but it's rather oddly, he's confident in that luck, Peter. Yeah, he's confident that he's going to be lucky. He had to be fighting the way he did.
Do you not think it's only a matter of time before he's killed?
Well, it has to be because, you know, we've said it in a previous podcast, the Richthofen podcast, I think it was. When a bullet strikes an aircraft, it can strike anywhere in that aircraft. It could strike the fuel tank, for example. So he's getting hit regularly. It's a matter of time.
But for the moment, he's going from victory to victory. He's given some leave at home, comes back to France on 11th of September. By this time, he's been honoured, hasn't he? What's he got by this time?
Yeah, he's been awarded the DSO and bar to join his MC.
And he's commanding A flight of 60 Squadron. Now, do you think he was a conscientious flight commander?
Well, he certainly performs the duties conscientiously of the flight commander, but he continues to fly, Pete.
I'm glad you could say fly.
Yeah, that's the only word I can. Any more than three letters. One, two, three, lots. I'm in trouble. Now, he continues to fly as many additional solo offensive patrols as possible. And on the 15th of September, he went up on several missions and had a brisk encounter with five Roland two-seaters.
Now, why is the 15th of September? Why is he so busy on that day? What could be happening?
I don't know, Pete. It's a party down below.
Bit of a party. The Battle of Flares Courcelette. Yep, that's it. That's what's going on. And we always want to remind people the air war hots up when the ground war hots up. Anyway, you're going to say what Lieutenant Albert Ball experiences on the 15th of September.
Five Rolands seen over Bapaume in formation. Newport dived and fired rockets in order to break up the formation. Formation was lost at once. Newport chased the nearest machine and got under it, firing one drum at 20 yards. Hostile aircraft went down quite out of control and crashed northeast of Bertincourt.
Now, these are taken not from his letters. When it's in this strange, impersonal thing, it's a combat report.
Yeah, because the Newport he's referring to is him.
Yeah, that's him. Now, he'd been on patrol intending to attack German observation balloons. He's developed an alternative use he's got incendiary Le Prieur rockets that now they're attached to his wing struts. And so what does he? And you fire them by means of an electric switch. It zoops electricity along the wires and fires the rockets. Whoosh forward of the plane. What? How does he fire? What? How does he fire? They're for the balloons, but how does he use them?
Well, he uses them to disrupt the German formations over the following few weeks. So he just fires it into the formation. He's got no hope of hitting anything with it, but it just gives them a bit of a fright and forces them to separate.
Now, so we're now, despite all the odds, I think I'm going to say there, fighting's boiling up in September, late September, but he's still alive, isn't he? He's still alive, he's still in the skies, and he's still causing mayhem. By this time, he's in a Newport 17, I think. Now, what have the Germans got? What's the problem here? What have the Germans got?
Well, he was up in behaving conscientiously.
No.
Newport 17. Now, I'm just showing you I can use the word conscientiously, Pete. But the Germans...
Oh, Gary, sometimes you just want to show your better side.
Yeah. Now, the problem is his Newport 17 is not as fast or powerfully armed as the Albatross D1. So this is the Albatross Scout. But it did turn in a tighter turning circle, and it was more agile in close combat. But that's it. So the Newport's clearly, therefore, inferior.
But it can hold its own just about. It's not like the DH2, which is utterly outclassed. It's got more than a tight turning circle. It's more agile. It's faster. It's just better. But the Albatross is still clear. And especially in the hands of someone like Ball, I suppose you'd say.
Yeah, a skilled pilot could do a lot with it, yeah.
Now, some more combat reports. 21st of September, he runs into six Roland scouts this time, and you're going to read this one.
Hostile aircraft, HA.
Let's call it HA from now on, if that's all right. That's what it means, hostile aircraft.
Well, he certainly does, yeah.
Yeah.
Seen north of Bay Palm in formation. Newport dived and fired rockets. Formation was lost. Newport got underneath nearest machine and fired a drum. HA dived and landed near railway. Newport then attacked another machine and fired two drums from underneath. HA went down and was seen to crash at side of railway. After this, the rest of the HA followed Newport towards the lines. Newport turned and fired remainder of ammunition, after which it returned to aerodrome for more. Second machine was seen to crash by Lieutenant Waters.
In combat reports, he'll always try and assign, you know, to, when he's claiming kills, he needs corroboration. 2 days later, on 23rd of September, he's back in the thick of it, isn't he? And this time he's carrying a new Buckingham tracer incendiary ammunition. That's interesting. That's for shooting balloons down, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah. He says, four Rolands were seen coming from Cambrai towards Moree. Newport got behind them and fired a drum at 30 yards range. This made them separate. Newport then made for the nearest machine and got underneath it, firing one drum. This drum had no effect on the HA, for Newport could not get near enough. Newport then made for another and succeeded in getting within 15 yards underneath, at which range 90 rounds of 1-in-3 Buckingham were fired. HA was on fire before 15 rounds were fired, but it was observed to go out before crashing on the ground near Moree. The remainder of the HA surrounded the Newport after this, for it had no ammunition. Newport only got 13 hits on its planes.
As you say, it could be anywhere, couldn't it? That's the wings, but it could have been anywhere. Now, 25th of September, a couple of days later, there's another... I refer to it in the book as a splendid tussle with just a one German two-seater. And it must have been a brilliant crew, mustn't it?
It must have been. Now, his usual tactics are thwarted by the skill of these German pilots, and he couldn't get close.
This German pilot?
Yeah.
Sorry, I do apologise.
Oh, sorry, by the German pilot, yes. And he couldn't get close to the usual deadly range. And these are the first reports he signed following his promotion to captain, aren't they, Pete? And you're going to be Captain Albert Ball now.
Did you get promoted this quick? So that's three promotions, best part of a year. No? I'll carry on. We kept on firing until we had used up all our ammunition. Again, this is... we is him. There was nothing more to be done after that, so we both burst out laughing. We couldn't help it. It was so ridiculous. Now, I've made a mistake there. The we is actually that pilot and the gunner of the German two-seater. So I'm an idiot. We couldn't help it. It was so ridiculous. We flew side by side, laughing at each other for a few seconds, and then we waved adieu to each other and went off. He was a real sport, that Hun.
Yes.
Lot of problem with how many there were with that whole incident. Now, the same day. What happens the same day?
Well, he has another desperate tussle. And this stage, he's using a Lewis gun fitted with the newly issued double drums of ammunition.
Now, a lot of people think that there would be 2 times 47, that would be 94 rounds.
No, these were Pan magazines, Pete, and they held 97 rounds. Yes!
Now, this is Albert Ball, same day as the previous thing. Can you have any idea of the tension? So pilots sort of take off, land, take off. So they're completely safe on the ground.
Well, if they're lucky, they take off and land.
Yeah, well... Yes, but they're completely safe or they're in the most desperate danger. And this is Newport. This is not Newport.
This is Captain Albert, but this is going well today, Pete.
Everything's going perfectly, isn't it? Newport could not see any HA over Bapaume at a reasonable height, so he went along the Cambrai Road. After being there for a few minutes, 2 formations came along. Newport attacked the first. The HA ran with noses down. But when another formation came near, it turned towards the Newport. Newport fired 1 drum to scatter formation, after which it turned to change drums. One of the drums dropped into the rudder control, and for a few seconds, Newport was out of control. Newport succeeded in getting drum on gun and attacked an albatross, which was then flying at its side. Newport fired 90 rounds of 1-in-3 Buckingham at about 15 yards range underneath HA. HA went down, quite out of control, and crashed. The remainder of HA followed Newport, but in the end left. In order to keep them off at safe range, Newport kept turning towards them. Each time this was done, HA made off with their noses down. Wow, what a scrap that was.
Now, towards the end of September, he's become aware that the risks he's taken in combat had moved from the intrepid through to rash and then, frankly, suicidal. But he has to carry on fighting, doesn't he, Pete? And some of the sights he sees seems to have affected him quite deeply. And
well, this is one, isn't it? This is from a letter. You can tell the personal tone. And he says this: "She was a 2-seater and I fired 5 rounds into her. She burst into flames and fell upside down. Although she dropped like a stone, I saw her observer climb out of his seat and jump clear of the flames. He must have preferred that kind of death to the chance of being roasted." And, wow, that's quite a quote, isn't it?
Now, he's tortured, isn't he, Pete? At least to some extent, by the knowledge of the murderous nature of his trade. And this quote you're going to read, and I think it's quite telling about his state of mind at the time.
It is. I feel so sorry for the chaps I have killed. Just imagine what their poor people must feel like. However, it must be done, or they would kill me. Wow. Yeah. I mean, he's not a murderous type, really, in the sense. He's fighting the cause of his country and he's doing what has to be done. But what do you think's happening to him as we move into this phase, late September and into October? Well, late September.
His nerves are stretching ever tighter, aren't they? And he's exhausted. And in short, he's suffering, not surprisingly, from combat fatigue, Pete, isn't he?
Wouldn't have known what it was at the time, like post-traumatic stress disorder. It's not terms of the time, not lack of moral fibre. That's the Second World War. His nerves are just a bit stretched. Does that affect his performance? His last flight, 1st of October, is his last flight. Is he performing badly, do you think?
No, I mean, he's asked his squadron leader, Major Smith Barry, if he could go home. And it's treated with due respect and it's approved. But as you say, on the 1st of October, it's his last flight. And he's as active as ever. And it results in 3 more claims.
Now, claims are quite interesting, aren't they? By this time, how many has he claimed?
Well, he's got some 31 victories and, you know... by the standards then prevailing in the RSC. So I queried this yesterday, Pete. I'm going to query it again. I don't understand what that phrase means.
Well, what it is that it's not an accurate business claims, especially at this phase in the war. At this point, the RFC would allow a claim for an aircraft that was forced to land, especially earlier in the thing. So it doesn't have to be shot down. It just has to be forced down, that kind of thing. There's another reason, just to put it very briefly. If you could imagine you're in combat with several German aircraft and you hit one, and it starts to flutter down, or a bit of smoke comes out of it, you're being attacked by, say, four more or five more aircraft. Do you watch the first aircraft to make sure it goes down? Or do you just have a guess at what happens to it? What would you do?
Well, you have a guess. And again, in other podcasts, we talked about other scout pilots who had the mantra of not following a stricken aircraft down to make sure that it had crashed. Because, you know, the lower you go, the more that you come into contact with troops on the ground that can shoot and things like that. So if it's on fire, it's going down, it's smoking, you assume that it's a victory.
And the other thing is to remember is with Ball especially, he's normally on he does do his normal patrols, but he does a lot of solo work. And if you solo work, there's no one else to see it. There's no one else to do it. And also, there's no one to protect your tail. Now, later on in 1917, they'll develop their flying formations a lot more. They try to crash into the Germans and shoot them all down. But when you're on your own against 4, 5, 10, 12, 15 aircraft, you don't have time. There's nothing you can do to make sure. So they're 31 victories. They're sort of real, but would you bet on each one being that one? No. They're an estimate more than anything else. Does that mean we don't respect his achievement?
Not at all. You know, he was at that time certainly the leading British ace. And as we've said on a number of occasions, he was unique. You know, nobody else could do what he was doing.
But he's inspirational to others. What do you think gets inspirational about him? It's not, you've explained, it's not his fighting technique. Is it? It's his courage. And
It begs the question why the powers that be, for want of a better word, didn't use him differently and remove him from the dangers that he was clearly suffering from and use him in some sort of propaganda role or back at home or training. And you know, we've said this about a number of scout pilots. They miss being in the mix of it when they're out of it. I'm sure we'll talk about Ball again in the future, but at this point in time, you know, he's safe, yes.
So he goes back to England, he's on a training roll, but he comes back out again in April 1917. I wonder how he'll fare then. I wonder why the date of 7th of May, your birthday, would be so important to him. What could be going to happen?
Well, we're going to have to wait and see. You're going to have to remember that date longer. I do apologise, Pete. I'm going to give these teeth back to the horse now. they're clearly not for talking, they're for chewing. I've enjoyed today, Pete. It's an exciting podcast. And you've got to bear in mind the context of it happening above the Somme battle. You know, in terms of historical context, it's an amazing period of time.
I agree. Thank you very much, Gary.
Cheers, Pete. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?